KCRW sponsors include Disney, presenting Young Woman and the Sea, an incredible true story from producer Jerry Bruckheimer and starring Daisy Ridley, now playing in select theaters.
Members celebrating in North Hollywood last night over the news that after 118 days, they can pack up their picket signs. The union reached a tentative deal with Hollywood studios yesterday. Details of the new contract have not been released yet. But SAG's negotiating committee said in a statement the deal is valued at more than $1 billion. With major pay increases, a streaming participation bonus, and new regulations for AI.
I hope people, you know, at the end of the day, see what a monumental contract this is. I mean, there was so many things that had to move, so many things that had to shift and change.
That's Natalia Castellanos, a member of SAG's negotiating committee, speaking last night. Joining me now to discuss what we can expect to happen next in Hollywood is Matt Bellany, founding partner of the website Puck News and a regular contributor to KCRW's The Business. Hi there.
Hi there.
All right, so we don't have the exact details yet, right? Those will be released tomorrow, from what I understand. But they're saying that this is valued over $1 billion. They got minimum increases. They got a streaming bonus. They got regulations on AI. What do you know about what's in this?
Yeah, I interviewed Duncan Crabtree Ireland, the executive director, last night and pressed him on the specifics, because as you are correct in saying, we don't actually know the specifics, and the devil will be in the details here. But at least broadly, they got wage increases that are above what the sister unions got, the Directors Guild and the Writers Guild. Percentage-wise, they got 5% increases. And while we don't know the exact percentage, SAG got a larger increase, which they consider a win. Now, they were seeking 11%. I doubt they got that, but they got somewhere between 5 and 11%. On the streaming bonus, they didn't get what they wanted. They wanted a percentage of revenue from the studios and streamers. And that was a non-starter. They were waived off of that from the beginning. The studio side never wavered in that. And ultimately, they settled for something similar to what the Writers Guild got, which is a streaming bonus. Their members will get bonused if the percentage of viewers of a certain show goes above a threshold. And we don't know the exact threshold and how that's going to work out just yet. There is something unique in that there's a revenue pool that is this money is going to go into that the guild will then administer, Duncan has said. But we don't know the specifics of that yet. But that is a new residual. That is something that did not exist before this strike, and they will be able to build on that in subsequent negotiations. So that's a win. And then on AI, they say they got some pretty significant concessions from the studios on how they can and cannot use AI. And that was actually the sticking point at the very end. The studios wanted to be able to use actors' images that they have paid for in movies to create synthetic actors, meaning fake actors that are based on, you know, characteristics of other actors. And SAG really put up a fight on that. They wanted consent and compensation for that use. They say they got it. We will see if there are any caveats or excuses that will allow the studios to experiment. That's coming on Friday once the national board has a chance to vote on this.
Got it. Okay. So speaking of AI, there was some news earlier this week that one of the sticking points was using the likeness of dead actors to bring them back, if you will, and create new products with those actors. Is that in this at all? And the actors fought back on that, of course, I guess the studios wanted to do that without permission from the estate necessarily. So is that in this? Do we know?
Duncan Crabtree Ireland told me that that reporting was not accurate, that was not what they were fighting about at the end. And I interviewed him on the Town podcast, and he did say, now we will see what the language is, but he did say that that was not what they were fighting about at the end. It was really this issue of what actor likenesses could be used to create synthetic actors, and this notion of, dead actors being used in perpetuity without permission from their estate. That was not on the table at the end, according to him. We'll see what's in the deal.
Right. Now, what about the bonus issue that you talked about, mm-hmm. the streaming bonus? What does that mean exactly? Does that mean a bonus for new product going forward, for old product? Do we know anything about that, looking perhaps at the writer's strike, writer's contract?
Yeah. The template for this was the Writers Guild deal. So if we go by that template, it's for originals. It's for stuff that is made for streaming. It has nothing to do with, you know, a situation like Suits, where it was made years ago and then mm-hmm. licensed to Netflix and has a new life on Netflix. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about shows that are made for streaming and become big hits on streaming. There will now be a residuals bonus for streaming hits. And the exact calculation of that is not known, but it's a little different from the writer's situation, he told me, because there's going to be a pool of money that will be administered by the union. And that's different from the writers, because I think it's designed to reflect the fact that there are more actors on a show than there are writers, obviously, typically, and they will be able to have a voice in how that is apportioned out. That's what we are told. Again, we will see what it says in the deal.
Okay. And ratification is expected, right? There isn't any idea that, okay.
I mean, that's the formality. It has to go to the national board and then be ratified by the full union. But the negotiating committee voted unanimously to pass this. And that is usually a signal of solidarity in the guild, and there won't be much opposition.
Okay. Why did this take so long, and why now? Why did they decide now to resolve this when they've been negotiating for lo these many months?
I think I asked Duncan that exact question, and he said that it took so long because the studios really were dug in on some of the key issues, on sharing revenue, sharing profits, and on the AI issue. And they felt that it was worth holding out for and standing up. And he went through specifically and said there are many things that were not offered when, you know, the day before the guild went on strike that are now in this deal. So he uses that as evidence that this strike was absolutely worth it for the guild. The reason it went so long, you know, you gotta, it's, these things are really complicated. And this was not just about money. Typically, money disputes can be resolved quicker, but this was about some more fundamental issues of being an actor and what rights you get in your likeness and your image with new technology emerging. And that's a really difficult situation to overcome. Now, why did it end now? I think that a couple of factors. I think objectively, the frustration level around town was getting higher and higher. Most people thought that after the Writers Guild took so long to get their deal, that the actors would hammer out some specific issues for them, but wouldn't go into a prolonged standoff like we saw over the past month. And I think also the studios gave a deadline. They said, you know, here we've come to you on a number of issues. We're giving you till 5 o'clock. And if not, mm-hmm. then we've got to start canceling shows that we think we can, you know, currently, if we go back, we can make up the second half of the TV season. We can make our summer release dates. But if you don't take this deal now, we're probably not going to make those dates. So we're going to have to change the tenor of this negotiation. I think that was effective.
Oh, wow. All right. So what does that mean then? When will they get back to work? And what does that mean for the schedule for the next, what, 6 months?
Yeah, I think, first of all, it shows that stopped production, that have everything set up and, you know, the actors were contracted to do it and they will now just need to restart. It will likely take a week or two to do that. The lists that I have seen floating around town that, you know, the shows that are on those lists that are starting first are the broadcast network shows, the stuff that they really need to go into production now because they want to make the mid-season premiere dates.
Okay. And what about movies?
And movies, it's the ones that just, you know, things that needed reshoots. Like, for instance, the Deadpool movie that's supposed to come out next summer. That movie is almost done finishing shooting. Not almost, but close. So they're going to try to rush that as soon as possible. There's a couple of others that are, you know, that are trying to make a release date and have been sitting on their production, like waiting for this day for a couple months now. Those are going to be first. And then I think slowly new productions will start. Because remember, there's now a logjam of 6 months of productions that are all going after the same crews, the same actors, same sets, the same shooting locations. It's going to be a really logistical nightmare to try to figure out this stuff out. And it's going to be a fight for a number of these productions. The actors can't be everywhere at once.
All right. Well, maybe that's a fight they want to have. Too much work rather than not.
Of course, that's a fight they want to have. Yeah. I mean, and we're heading into the holidays as well. And, you know, the holiday breaks are guild mandated. They're in the contract. So it's really tough. You can't just say, oh, let's go, you know, through Christmas. You can't do that.
Yeah. All right. Matt, always great to talk to you. Thanks for coming on.
No problem.
Matt Bellamy, founding partner at Puck News, and he's also a contributor to The Business here on KCRW. Coming up, new documents show Mark Zuckerberg was warned by his own executives that young people, especially girls, were being harmed by Instagram, and that he allegedly brushed off those warnings. That's next on Press Play.
Former dancer and current owner of Lake Girls Theater, Kata Pierce Morgan, peels back the layers of stripper energy, fighting back from the fringes.
I'm sure there's many people who don't have the slightest idea what goes on at Lake Girls.
When we come back, new dancers.
The stereotypes.
Are some of the dancers also prostitutes?
Could be pretty horrendous.
Doesn't it set you up for the possibility of violence?
The only abuse, physical abuse, that the dancers have ever experienced has been from the vice squad.
We obviously had a misunderstanding. We had a thing of improper procedure. Improper procedure.
If a vice officer takes control of a young dancer, they feel that the dancers are pretty much their property. Their property.
Nobody's coming to save us. We have to save ourselves.
You know, fight or flight, I'm the fighter.
Kata gives us unlimited access to a half century of archival material that chronicles her story, as well as the history of Lake Girls, the women who danced there, and the fierce activism launched from the unlikely stage of a strip club.
I'm this tough young woman, you know, I'll punch you in the nose. And I did.
Prepare for sassy strippers, corrupt cops, and a rare look inside the historic Lake Girls Theater. More information at kpbs.org/stripper energy.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A few weeks ago on this show, we talked about how California and 40 other states, as well as Washington, D.C., sued Meta, the parent company of Instagram and Facebook. They allege that Meta intentionally built addictive features into the platforms, knowing full well how harmful they are to kids and teenagers. Now there's a new wrinkle. Newly unredacted portions of a lawsuit by Massachusetts claim top Meta executives warned CEO Mark Zuckerberg for years about the negative effects of Facebook and Instagram and urged him to implement more safety features, all of which Zuckerberg allegedly and repeatedly ignored. Jeff Horwitz is a technology reporter for The Wall Street Journal who's been closely following this story. He's part of the team of reporters there that detailed Meta's deceptive practices in a series called The Facebook Files, and his book, Broken Code, Inside Facebook and the Fight to Expose Its Harmful Secrets, comes out next week. Welcome back to Press Play, Jeff.
Thank you.
All right. So tell us more about what Massachusetts is alleging and this unredacted document and what it says about what Mark Zuckerberg knew when.
So a lot of what the attorney generals were previously talking about and sort of some of the things that were immediately obvious in their suit were all allegations drawn from documents provided to the journal and then to Congress as well by Frances Haugen, a former Facebook employee who took more than 20,000 screenshots of sensitive internal work product because she was concerned the company was failing to live up to its societal responsibilities. And you know, that was interesting to see that get picked up. But I think what is really interesting about the unsealed filing, members of the company's senior leadership are discussing the issues a little more candidly among themselves than they did in public, perhaps. And also that in which Mark Zuckerberg is repeatedly sort of taking the naysayer role in terms of potential improvements.
So tell us more about what these executives are warning Zuckerberg about. And these are executives really high up in the company, such as the head of Instagram. And what are they saying the product, Instagram and Facebook, what are they saying is they're doing that is harming teenagers?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things. I mean, starting back in 2019, the company's then head of research was saying that Instagram was a net negative for mental health. And that's, you know, obviously pretty damning right there. But I think what really became interesting was in 2019, there was also this effort to limit filters, beauty filters. Basically, these are kind of AI enhancement features that you can use to take a picture of yourself and have, you know, better cheekbones, poutier lips, longer lashes, and so forth. And, you know, the company's well-being researchers had talked to more than 20 experts who said, yeah, this is going to be really bad. It's going to make people feel bad about themselves. This is not a good idea. And it turns out that almost all of the company's senior product and safety staff said, okay, we're going to just ban these things. That's our plan. Mark Zuckerberg then said no, claiming, according to the lawsuit, falsely that he'd seen no data that the filters were harmful, and noting that there was demand for the product. Meta, you know, disagrees with a lot of things about the Massachusetts complaint. But I think what's really important here is that you do have a middle-aged man overruling his own staff's expertise, consulting experts related to teenage mental health, and in particular that of girls.
Mm-hmm. Let me play a clip of tape from Arturo Bahar. He's a former Meta engineering executive who testified before Congress this week. And here he is talking about the response to the concerns his fellow executives raised, as you mentioned, and that's your coverage highlighted.
I observed new features being developed in response to public outcry, which were in reality kind of a placebo, a safety feature in name only, to placate the press and regulators. I say this because, rather than being based on user experience data, they were based on very deliberately narrow definitions of harm. The company was grading its own homework.
That's interesting. What does he mean by that? The company was grading its own homework.
So this is a really interesting thing that I think we're looking at again right now in some other contexts. But the company has for a long time really relied on this one sort of metric of potential harmful activity, which is prevalence. What portion of overall views of content out of the total billions and billions per day, what portion of them is bad news, right? And those numbers are actually very low. Like, so bullying and harassment is, you know, in the single digits out of 10,000. You know, nudity is rare. Child exploitation is so low that it can't even be measured. The interesting thing, though, is that these harms are defined very narrowly, and they are enforced by algorithmic systems that are not always, shall we say, good on the nuance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, one of Bahar's concerns was that people sending lewd, you know, inquiries to a teenager, that actually wasn't even a violation of Meta's rules. And so that they weren't measuring what users experienced, and they were, you know, sort of downplaying almost to the point of non-existence issues that the platform might be aggravating.
And he really became attuned to all this through his daughter, his 14-year-old daughter, because she was being harassed for being a girl working on old cars. She was doing that with her dad as a hobby, fixing up antique cars, and she got a lot of harassment for that.
Yeah, no, it's sort of a crazy story. He left in 2015 because he was in the middle of a divorce, wanted to spend more time with his kids. And one of the ways he did that was he started teaching his daughter car restoration, which is a passion of his and of hers. And she created an Instagram account and to document it. And that's kind of where the trouble began, because while there were a lot of people who were like, oh, neat, it's a young woman getting involved in a hobby that is traditionally male focused. There were also just people who came out of the woodwork with just absolutely awful commentary. And then also, you know, she also was experiencing people sending her pictures of their penis, which is unfortunately not uncommon for young women on the internet. I think the thing here is that Instagram was sort of directing people to her profile, and, you know, that Bahar was very concerned that it wasn't doing anything about this stuff.
So he brings this to the company and they kind of just shrug their shoulders and say, not much we can do about it. Sorry.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, the thing that Bahar did during his time there, I think the central thing, and I spent a couple of years talking with him, was he tried to get the company to look not just at prevalence, you know, just sort of how often, you know, Meta's sort of tally of how many bad things happen, but on what users actually experience, to sort of draw leadership's attention to the idea that they were sort of living in a false they were living in a false reality, sort of, in which they'd constructed data that seemed to suggest everything was all right when it definitely wasn't.
So are these people, Bahar and the other top executives, are they going to be testifying for the states, for the attorneys general?
Bahar certainly is. And, you know, he was consulting with them for a long time. And I think he's cited in a few of the attorney general suits. The other ones, though, that we were talking about that were suggesting that there was underinvestment, those are current executives at the company for the most part. You know, I think what was interesting about the unsealed documents just from this week is that these are people who have sort of taken the company line in public, but in private seem to have been pretty uncomfortable that there weren't more resources going into addressing problems that they considered to be real.
Jeff Horowitz, tech reporter for The Wall Street Journal. His book, Broken Code, Inside Facebook and the Fight to Expose Its Harmful Secrets, comes out next week. What timing, Jeff, for your book.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll have your weekend movie reviews, including the latest Marvel film.
It felt to me like just kind of a long episode of television, in part because the stakes felt so kind of secondary.
Also, a weird Nicolas Cage movie in which he appears in everyone's dreams. That's next on Press Play. You're listening to KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time for film reviews. And of course, we will talk about the latest from Marvel, but that will be your dessert at the end of this segment. We're also going to talk about Nicolas Cage continuing his prestige film Victory Lab, this time as a dream invading professor in the latest from indie darling A24. We'll talk about Justin Long playing a murderous villain in a Christmas slasher and a Sundance documentary about the critical role of hospital chaplains in helping people navigate death and grief. Joining us to discuss his films, we have with us William Bibbiani, co-host of the critically acclaimed network. Welcome back, Bibbs.
Hello.
And Allison Wilmore, film critic for New York Magazine and Vulture. Welcome back, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you both. Okay, first up, that Nicolas Cage movie, it's called Dream Scenario, and Nicolas Cage finds himself in everyone's dreams.
Have you been dreaming about me?
Have I been dreaming about you?
Yeah.
There's like 100 messages. Somebody wants to interview me.
Well, this is strange. Maybe you should take a minute and think before you do anything drastic.
Why me? I don't know. I'm special, I guess.
Okay, so Allison, tell us more about Nicolas Cage. He plays kind of an everyman dorky guy, and everyone's dreaming about him. Why?
Yeah, this film has a really interesting premise. So Nicolas Cage's character is a biology professor. He's, you know, got tenure. He's got this kind of comfortable life. He has this great marriage to Julianne Nicholson, but he's also clearly never, he's got a lot of envy about, you know, professional recognition. He has a book that he keeps saying he wants to write, but never gets around to. And then suddenly he is granted fame in the strangest way possible, which is that he starts turning up in the dreams of everyone, random strangers. First, he gets notified by people he knows, and then it turns out that this is a widespread phenomenon. And in these dreams, he is just standing there. I think the highlight of this movie, the dreams are kind of rendered in really spectacular, strange fashion. And in many of these dreams at the beginning, he's just an observer walking by, you know, all of these strange dream logic scenarios, just looking. this is I think the best way to describe this film, or maybe the best note on this film, is that it is produced by Ari Aster of Hereditary and Beau Is Afraid. Mm-hmm. If that tells you a bit about the kind of movie it is, it's got a very dark sense of humor and a very kind of surreal visual sensibility. And of course, you have Nicolas Cage, who is, you know, the most game actor of all time, willing to go in any strange directions. I think that this movie has a lot of promise while also having a bit of a gloss of attempting to be timely that I didn't think worked, which is that there are moments in the film where it tries to tell you that it is sort of a metaphor for going viral. Mm-hmm. And then getting canceled or getting, you know, milkshake ducking. There is essentially the character played by Nicolas Cage milkshake ducks without any, you know, conscious choice. And suddenly everyone turns on him and his notoriety becomes infamy. But I think I wish that part were just cut out. I wish every mention of equating this to going viral and getting canceled were cut out, because I think aside from that, it works quite well as this very quirky, unpredictable film about yearning for attention and yearning for fame, and then getting your wish in the worst way possible.
Yeah. You know, beware the lure of the sirens of fame. Bibbs, what do you think of this? And what did you think of his performance, Nicolas Cage's performance?
Look, everyone loves Nicolas Cage. Even in a bad movie, Nicolas Cage is usually wonderful. Nicolas Cage and honestly the whole cast are doing wonderful things with this material. But I agree with Allison and then some about the way that this movie takes a premise that, you know, you think about it in your head. Oh, you find yourself in everyone's dreams. Why is that happening? What does that mean? What does that signify? Think of all the ways that that story could spiral out. And by forcing the film with all of these unlimited possibilities to be almost oppressively only about one thing, only about accidentally becoming a meme and having that destroy your life. It doesn't just like date it like in like 20, 40 years. If we look back at this film, look at it, it is very much of its moment. It also just makes it really reductive. It ultimately like takes this all these wonderful ideas, all these wonderful dream sequences, and just says, hey, it's kind of like memes. And I'm like, okay. And anything else? No, that's it. That's all we got. And I'm like,
that's it?
Oh. This could have been a meme.
Yeah. And who's in his dreams?
Nicolas Cage.
Oh, okay. Dream Scenario in select theaters Friday with a wider release next Friday. Next up, we have It's a Wonderful Knife, a film that wants to have Halloween on Christmas and features murders under the mistletoe.
Last Christmas still haunts me.
Time to let that go.
No one cares. Everyone would be better off if I was never born.
Did you see that? Did the power go out?
Oh my God.
All right, Bibbs, what did you make of this twist on It's a Wonderful Life? Did it work for you?
This is a delightful twist, and It's a Wonderful Life. The film stars Jane Whittup as a teenager who, one Christmas, stops a slasher in the middle of a killing spree. And it turns out it was this famous person in the community, played by Justin Long. And a year later, everything sucks. Her life is miserable. No one's helping her with all of her mental health issues after this traumatic incident. The people around her seem to have changed. She just feels miserable. And she makes the mistake of wishing the exact same thing James Stewart wished in It's a Wonderful Life, which is basically that she had never been born. And then she goes to a version of the town where the slasher had never been stopped. And only she knows who it is. And only she knows how to stop what's been essentially a nonstop killing spree ever since that first Christmas night. It's a really, really fun twist on a very familiar premise. It's a clever screenplay that does a lot with the material. The cast is just uniformly excellent. Jane Whittup is wonderful. Joel McHale, Justin Long is just becoming like increasingly like his generation's Vincent Price, which I am totally fine with. You got Catherine Isabel, who's becoming a genre legend at this point as well. It's just delightful. The only thing that really holds it back is that it's got this unfortunate kind of low-budget TV movie patina around it that just makes it look like a little cheaper than it needs to. I suspect that's on purpose to make it feel like a Hallmark movie gone wrong. But I think maybe they take it a little bit far. But regardless, it's clever. It's fun. It's kind of romantic in a weird way. I love this movie. I think it's a great slasher.
Allison, what did you think of this one? Justin Long, a far cry from his Mac spokesman days, I guess, although maybe some people think, you know, Apple is the devil. What did you think of him in this?
You know, I loved the premise of this film. I think the idea of having a slasher variation on a Christmas classic like It's a Wonderful Life is wonderful. And I think there are aspects of the way that it unfolds that I really appreciated, but I found the execution just kind of lacking. Like, as Bibbs mentioned, it does have this kind of Hallmark movie sheen that I think is probably deliberate, but also I think in addition to looking maybe deliberately chintzy, I think it also is not super effective in terms of its like slasher moments. You know, I think this is a comedy horror film, horror comedy, but I do think that the horror side is not especially strong, even in a kind of fun jump scare way. I think that it's not, there are very few moments that it manages to be frightening. But I think it has a premise that I just wanted more from. But like Bibbs, I also appreciated seeing Catherine Isabel, my favorite Canadian scream queen, and Justin Long as the smarmy mayor who kind of presents progress as, you know, like building up the town and knocking down things as like inevitable progress that's good for everyone is a kind of funny villain that is both, you know, sort of a gentrification as a villain and then also, serial killer villain. And I appreciated him embodying those both in one character.
I want to see Mr. Burns from The Simpsons in that role, maybe in the sequel.
Absolutely.
It's a Wonderful Knife opens Friday. Next, we have A Still Small Voice, a Sundance documentary that follows a young hospital chaplain through her year-long residency.
There's an old adage, don't just stand there, do something. And we flip that. We say, don't just do something, stand there or be there. Because there's connection and healing in that.
Oh. Allison, tell us more about this movie.
So this comes from a director named Luke Lawrenson, whose first movie I'd seen, it was called Midnight Family, and follows this family in Mexico City that runs a private ambulance service. Really interesting movie, but like—
That's a great movie. I love that movie.
Yeah, and it's just so tense, you know, because this family is like careening around the streets. So this film has a very different tone. It's obviously much more meditative, but it's also about people who are trying to be this kind of calm, reassuring presence at, you know, this really tough time in patients' lives. And I found it pretty remarkable, though it is a film that you have to kind of slow down and get on its level. You know, it mostly follows a woman named Mati, who is in this chaplain residency program at Mount Sinai in New York during the pandemic. So I think it was filmed in 2020. And so it's a particularly stressful time, but also doing kind of hospice care and doing work for people who are grieving or maybe who are dying is itself really stressful. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about this film is, in addition to getting to see some films of Mati at work, some scenes of her at work, you know, with obviously the agreement of the patients, is just astounding. And it just feels like a real privilege to kind of see those vulnerable moments in people's lives. But it is also about the stress of doing this job and the ways in which these characters or, you know, these subjects on the film who all kind of couch their stress with like very careful therapy speak eventually end up clashing. Two characters who are like very thoughtful and patient themselves, they both end up splintering in a way that really surprised me. It's a great film, and I definitely recommend finding it, especially if you're just interested in seeing what it means to kind of counsel to people in this context. I thought it really just was eye-opening for me.
A Still Small Voice in select theaters tomorrow and opens at the Lemley Royal next Friday, November 17th. Last up, we have something that is probably the complete opposite of that film, and that's the new Marvel movie called, well, The Marvels.
What is happening to me?
She's entangled our light-based powers, so we switch places whenever we use them.
Strong theory.
You can absorb light. I can see it. And Kamala.
Who's Kamala?
Hi.
She can turn light into physical matter, which I have never heard of.
I could totally show you.
No!
Bibbs, I guess Kamala is not Kamala Harris, but another Kamala. What did you think of this movie that stars women as both the heroes and the villain?
Well, I'll say this right now. The cast of this movie, the main cast, Brie Larson, Tayana Paris, and Iman Vellani, they are just absolute dynamite together. Individually and separately, it's a really wonderful team dynamic, even better than I would say than the team dynamic we saw in perhaps bigger team movies like The Avengers or Justice League. The problem is that the movie around them feels like an accumulation of studio notes. It is a story about, really at its heart, it's pretty simple. Captain Marvel did something wrong in her past. The villain has come back to sort of get revenge for it and do a larger world-destroying thing. And she has to team up with a teen superhero fan who has become a superhero and a more professional sort of S.H.I.E.L.D. agent. Who has become a superhero as well. And together they form a bond. They learn to sort of view each other for who they really are rather than how they have made them out to be. All of that stuff is really, really strong. But yeah, as an actual like plot narrative, that's where this movie is a little underwhelming. It's just go here, do this, go here, do this, fight this person, stop a giant negative space wedgie, and then we're out. But if you go to superhero movies for the plot, I would argue that you're usually not going to be very, very happy. Sometimes they're great, sometimes they're not. But what I think director Nia DaCosta is able to pull out of this giant studio project is a lot of really wonderful scenes of their performers being great together and giving you that sense of all of these cool superheroes are hanging out and I get to hang out with them. And on that level, I enjoyed it quite a lot.
What number Marvel movie is this? I'm lost count.
85.
For real? Yeah. Oh, my God.
And that's not including the TV shows.
I believe it is the 33rd Marvel movie. Yeah, that sounds like a joke as much as 85 does. Yeah,
I know. Allison, what did you think?
Bibbs, I think you're very kind of generous in terms of that idea of this being a kind of hangout movie. And it is true that if you turn up to a superhero movie for the plot, it's usually not the strongest suit or the kind of the place where you'd find the best payoff. I will say, though, I don't think it's wrong to turn up to a superhero movie wanting kind of structure or, you know, a build towards something. I found this movie really lacking in certain basic things that I would just want from like a big budget blockbuster. It felt to me like just kind of a long episode of television, in part because the stakes felt so kind of secondary. You know, it exists to be a crossover episode, essentially, you know, between these characters. And it felt to me like the movie treated like what they were then supposed to do is so secondary. And I think that would be fine if I maybe enjoyed the dynamics between these characters more. But, you know, I think like Captain Marvel, Brie Larson's character is someone who's only had like one outing before this and has shown up a bit. But like, it does feel like you're catching up with characters and then trying to piece together all of the things that have happened in the time in between. You know, I just don't feel as invested in this generation of Marvel characters the way I did, you know, in the earlier days of this mega franchise. And I do feel like, you know, there's been a lot of observations that this current phase of Marvel is maybe not very together, doesn't really feel like it has a lot of a direction. And I think that this film, you know, as much as it has some like really charismatic leads, it shows that. Like, it doesn't feel very clear that anyone knows where this franchise is going.
And Allison, if you're yearning for the Marvel movies of yore, maybe AI can step in and help you and create new movies from the old characters.
Madeline.
You know, let's not go too far here.
No one wants that, Madeline.
We may complain about the formula behind these, like getting too formulaic, but I don't think anyone wants an AI creator.
Well, some people might want that. The bean counters might want that.
No one with the audience's best interest at heart actually wants that.
Certainly money-wise.
All right. Whether or not you want the Marvels, it is with us. It's in theaters on Friday. And that does it for Film Reviews this week. Allison Wilmore, film critic for New York Magazine and Vulture, and William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the critically acclaimed network. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Evan Kleinman and I share our LA food cravings when we're away. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lentils?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
You know what that means. Our friend Evan Kleinman is back, literally back home after a couple of weeks in Italy where she vacationed and worked a little, too. She took a weaving workshop. And then she took a group through Parma and its environs on a food tour. Doesn't really sound like working. But Evan says whenever she's away for more than a week, she starts to crave LA comfort foods. And she's here to talk about that. Evan, hi.
Hi.
You were not working. That's not working. That doesn't count.
Yeah, it's working. It's definitely working.
Doesn't sound like it.
You know that it's working.
I know, I know.
And I actually brought all my whole rig with me and did interviews from there. And
yeah, you were on the show here, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Tell me, I mean, here you are in the capital of deliciousness, and yet you're craving LA food. Why?
I don't know what it is, but if I'm gone for more than a week, I start to literally have dreams about burritos. I just
really,
yeah, I miss Mexican food so much whenever I'm gone for more than a week. I just miss beans and tortillas and a chili. It's just, it's very strong. It's a very strong craving.
Interesting. So when you touch down at LAX, that's the first thing you do is go get a burrito?
Yeah, you know, I live in mid-city, and so that 24-hour Lucy's at the corner of Pico and La Brea is my stop. I always get a chili relleno burrito there, which I think they make pretty well. And it's massive, and it usually is great for that re-entry snack and one more meal.
Yum. I don't know if I could put half of it away. I would just eat the whole thing.
No, I've done that too many times. I've learned. What about you? You recently came back from doing some travel.
Yeah, I was in Spain, also the capital of deliciousness. And I wasn't really craving LA food, but when I come home, the first thing I do is go to Trader Joe's. That's, I don't know, it's just like a comfort stop for me. It's more like
reacquainting
myself with the neighborhood in LA.
And so we're going to turn the tables here. So what do you get there?
Oh, Trader Joe's, well, obviously the staples, but then I have I love Bamba, so I have to get myself a bag of Bamba.
Oh, the
peanutty
peanut.
Air pop stuff.
Yeah, the air. Yeah.
I don't even know what it is, but it's delicious.
The peanut flavored air.
Yeah. And I have to eat the whole thing. You just can't stop it, a handful or two.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, it's a comfort thing, I think. It's about plugging back into your life, right, in a non-stressful way.
It's so funny, but to me, the last place I would go is a grocery store. Whenever I do my first grocery store run when I'm back and I'm still jet lagged, I feel like I'm having an out-of-body experience. And I invariably come home with the weirdest choices.
Well, that's fun, too. But, you know, you see the people, the cashiers, you know, and you kind of say, oh, yeah, hi. Remember me?
I love that.
I know.
I love that.
So then when you're jet lagging, what is a good jet lag meal for you?
Well, the morning after I come home, and because usually when I come home, it's nighttime. And mm-hmm. so in the morning when I wake up, the Mexican pull is strong. So I always go to a little cafe near my house called CJ's. It's like a simple diner with a menu of like both Mexican and soul food items. Super homey. And I always get their huevos mexicanos, which are, you know, like scrambled eggs mixed with onion, tomato, jalapeno, and cilantro. And then it comes with rice and beans. And I just wish they had better tortillas, but I still eat those tortillas.
That sounds so good. I had an Arabic breakfast at Safi's when I got back this time, and it was to die for. It was so
delicious.
Oh my God,
that sounds so good. What was on the plate?
Okay, a lot. First answer, you get shakshuka, the way that they do it, which includes some ginger, which is interesting. And you get one of their delicious chopped salads. You get olives. You get, and here's the best part, grilled challah bread with clotted cream and avocado honey.
Maybe breakfast is the thing to do there because it's so hard to get in for dinner.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's definitely the thing to do. They also have this homemade yogurt, and then they put pine nuts on it and nigella seed and honey.
Oh, that sounds so good.
It's really good.
It's so funny that you say pine nuts because the next day after I got home, I went far out into the valley. I mean, for me, it was far out. And I went to Hayat's kitchen and I got kibbeh, which was made with ground beef and pine nuts. I mean, basically when I come home, I just want anything besides Italian food. I just want like the world of flavors.
You're not going to have pasta for a while.
No. In fact, I invited like my best girlfriends over for like a re-entry lunch. And I think they thought I was going to make them some fabulous thing with like aged this great Parmigiano I brought home, but instead I had bought a DIY hand roll kit from the joint, which is that fish butcher in Sherman Oaks that specializes in dry aging their fish.
Yes.
And they put together this DIY hand roll situation that is so
epic. For sushi.
Oh, for sushi. It was so good.
Yeah, that's the one thing you can't get in Italy is
Well, you can. You can, but you know,
but would you? I don't
know. We're blessed because we live, you know, on the Pacific coast.
Absolutely. And so, especially when you're traveling and eating a lot of rich food, you want to come back and maybe do a little bit of a cleanse. Not a real cleanse, just like eating fresh fruit and vegetables and that kind of thing.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, Spain too. I mean, so much cured meat, which is really delicious because it bears no resemblance to the cured meats we have here. But yeah, all I really want to do is eat carrots and eat iceberg lettuce.
Yeah. Iceberg lettuce. Okay.
The crunch. I like the crunch.
Oh, okay. All right.
I know you're very judgmental about my iceberg lettuce.
I am.
It's okay.
No, I'm not going to lie. Okay. So what I'm not judgmental about is store-bought rotisserie chicken, which we talked about on the show recently. But that's also
true.
A great re-entry meal.
Absolutely. And I mean, actually, the first thing I do with it is I rip all the meat off and put it on the side. And then I use the carcass to make a broth because one of the first things I want to eat when I come home is some kind of chicken broth-based soup with like pasta or rice in it. It's just like so comforting. And when you're having trouble sleeping, when you're jet lagged, that really settles you. And before you go to bed, just have a nice soup for dinner.
Yeah. And it's nothing says home like chicken soup.
Absolutely.
Evan Kleiman, welcome back. I'm glad you're home.
Thank you.
Evan is host of Case Irby's Good Food. You can listen Saturday mornings at 10. You can also subscribe to the podcast and the Good Food newsletter at caserw.com/goodfood. And what is on your show this week?
So we cover the huge brouhaha that's surrounding Carrot Giant's Grimway and Bald House's water use up in the Cuyama Basin. There is a lot going on legally right now up in the Cuyama Valley that surrounds water use by the giant carrot growers.
Ah, I
So
see.
we cover that story. And then, you know, Marino Restaurant is 40 years old, and we asked Sal and Mario, the brothers who run it, to tell tales from their family's foundational restaurant history in LA, and it is just such a fabulous conversation. And then I spoke to Chef Eric Ajapong, who wrote a really wonderful children's book that explains history, and it will facilitate discussions of culture and family with the little ones in your life.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. All right, definitely tune into that again. It's Saturday mornings at 10. Evan, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
And that's it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, Robin Estrin, and Zeke Reed. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Our technical director is Mario Saavedra, and Sue Margulies engineered today. Tune in right here tomorrow for KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. They will talk about the abortion rights movement in elections this week and across conservative swing states and what happened there and what it means for the Democrats as they go forward into trying to elect, reelect, rather, President Joe Biden when lots of people don't really want to reelect President Joe Biden. So that's Left, Right, and Center tomorrow at noon and 7 here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening this week. I'll be back with you on Monday.